Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Well, my first guest today is revolutionizing current thinking with his blog for Psychology Today, which is called Rethinking Psychology. And today, Dr. Eric Maisel wants us to rethink depression. He's the developer of noemetic psychology, and I'll introduce him properly in just one moment to learn more about that. In the second half of today's show, we'll be joined by Sarah Colliner, who's achieved great success in what I think has to be one of the toughest industries, especially for a woman, and it's usually male-dominated arena. It sees far more failure than success. But Sarah Colliner has managed to rise to the top in the world of stand-up comedy. She's also a writer for Chelsea Handler and a regular roundtable guest on the Chelsea Lately show. So if you're thinking today's segments have no connection, then think again, because they actually do. Let's get started. Dr. Eric Maisel is a licensed psychotherapist, a family therapist. He's widely regarded as America's foremost creativity coach. His interests include mental and emotional health, philosophy and the art of making meaning, and creativity and the creative life. Dr. Maisel provides workshops worldwide and presents at venues as diverse as the Paris Writers' Workshop, the Savannah College of Arts and Crafts, and the American Conservatory Theatre. He writes for Professional Artist Magazine, The Huffington Post, and Psychology Today. And he's written 40 books. He's a best-selling author, has written 40 books. His latest is Rethinking Depression, How to Shed Mental Health Labels and Create Personal Meaning. Dr. Eric Maisel, welcome to the show today.
Hi, Vicki. Can't we do stand-up comedy instead? You know the one about the two strawberries? Well, never mind.
I can never remember jokes. I don't look at, me. I remember funny stories, but jokes I can never remember. The punchline kind of defeats the object. Well, I'm pleased to have you back, Dr. Maisel. You joined us 2 years ago to discuss how to make obsessions work for us. And, of course, today we're going to talk about rethinking depression. And I think this is a really great book. So let's begin with this. Dr. Kirk Schneider, co-author of Existential Humanistic Therapy, says, and I'm going to paraphrase here, but he says that your work provides a riveting deconstruction of the mental health industry. It will provoke controversy, yet it's one of the most perspective guides to life fulfillment that he's ever read. So let's begin with that comment and tell us how you would describe rethinking depression.
Well, the main thing we're talking about is a certain transaction that goes on, and that is a person comes into a mental health provider's office with unhappiness, sadness, anguish, despair, one of those human things, and comes out with a label, the mental disorder label of depression. And the way this works is that you are diagnosed on the basis of what's called a symptom picture, which is not a really legitimate way to diagnose a person. You should be diagnosed based on some explanations as to what's going on underneath, but mental health providers know that they don't know what's going on underneath. So they diagnose on the basis of symptom pictures, namely, are you sleeping too much or too little? Are you eating too much or too little, etc.? Things which really have nothing to do with this thing called depression necessarily. And so you end up with this label, and you end up with, of course, the two things that the mental health profession can provide, namely, chemicals with effects, known as antidepressants, and talk of a certain sort, known as psychotherapy. And you may want those two things. You may want the effects that chemicals provide, and you may want that talk, but it's really not a medical-sounding enterprise. It's more a much more human enterprise where you walk in with unhappiness and you come out with a label.
Mm. I you know, I talk to a lot of people, obviously, and I have read a lot of research on this subject, and I've read consistently that often the placebo tablet has more impact than actual medication. And of course, another big part of that is that we really can't measure how much, if somebody does need, clinical help, we can't really measure how much. It's all trial and error, isn't it?
Yes, and there are no tests to run for depression because there's no such thing. It's imagine trying to run a test for sadness. That's why you're not offered tests, because there are no logical tests to run for unhappiness. So I think that this is a real buyer beware moment, especially since you may or may not know that the new manual that therapists use to diagnose by is coming out in 2013. It's a revision of the current manual. And there are going to be scores and scores of new mental disorders, all created by folks sitting around in a room saying, can we make this a mental disorder? Can we make that a mental disorder?
Right.
Even grief, which used to be a depression exemption, used to be exempt from getting the label depressed if you were grieving the loss of a loved one. Well, they want to change that and make grief a mental disorder. If you're grieving for too long, well, then you're mentally disordered.
Mm.
So it's really important that folks be aware of what's going on. That's not to say, I've got to repeat myself, it's not to say you may not want what they dispense. You may want those chemicals, just as some people may want, you know, three scotches to feel less shy. People have taken chemicals for their effects forever. And so you may want those. And also, you better not rush to get off your chemicals if you're on them, because that can have precipitous effects.
Right, absolutely.
So we want to be careful there, you know, in discussing the chemical piece of this.
Yes, and I think it's also important to say, you say this in the book, never, not once am I going to say that you're not experiencing what it is that you may be experiencing. Never am I going to say, just cheer up. And never am I going to imply that nothing biological is going on. But you, the whole thrust of the book, my takeaway was that we've really replaced the word unhappy with depression in many cases.
Internally, I think we've entirely replaced it. I think people are embarrassed to say I'm sad or I'm unhappy. It doesn't even occur to them to use that language. Everybody's using the depression language now. So that makes the transaction so much more easy. If you walk in already ready to use the word depression, you're naturally going to be handed the word back to you. That's why this is a, so to speak, global epidemic. And that's because everybody's beginning to use the word depression internally around the world. And so we have more and more, quote, cases of depression. And it's really just people reframing the language they used to use around unhappiness or sadness into this current language of depression.
Mm. And so the whole first part of your book is really about is about this and debunking some of this. Why do you think we are so attached to labels? Why do we want to always fit into this neat little box?
Well, I think I provide, I'm not quite sure, maybe 15 reasons, but I think they're all obvious ones. We're bombarded by drug advertisements all day long. That's one reason. We're made to think that there is this illness. So it's not unnatural that we might believe that there is such a thing. Everybody appearing on talk shows typically will be using the word and acting as if it's a real thing. So that's another reason why it seems so natural. And just the idea that everybody's buying into it makes you want to buy into it, because it just seems so ubiquitous. It's just everywhere. I think it's really hard always to be out of lockstep with your culture and have your own ideas and maybe point a finger and wonder if, you know, the emperor maybe is naked. It's very hard for people to be what's essentially a whistleblower of one and blow a whistle on this particular sort of game.
Yeah, and there are more books out there now. I mean, people are recognizing that maybe we have fallen into this trap of, you know, following the pharmaceutical trail, when maybe
yes,
there are better alternatives.
That's right.
Out
and there have been voices saying this for 30 or 40 years. Thomas Zaz is one of my heroes. He's been talking about the myth of mental illness for 40 years or more. So there have been isolated voices. It's just that, you know, we get drowned out by the mental health profession that is so large and, you know, so powerful.
Right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk about, you know, how we approach somebody or how we handle this ourselves if we've been living with, quote, depression for all these years, and take it there, because the whole second part of the book is your program for pulling ourselves out of this. And my guest is Dr. Eric Maisel. His book is called Rethinking Depression, How to Shed Mental Health Labels and Create Personal Meaning. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please do stay with us.
This world, total in trouble. My home's in heaven. I'm going there. I'm going where?
no depression. Better land is free from care.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
Remember, you're listening to Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
I'm going where there's no depression, to a better land that's free from care. I'll leave this world a toil and trouble. My home's in heaven, I'm going there.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my guest is Dr. Eric Maisel. He's a licensed psychotherapist. In fact, you have 4 degrees. You are really well educated there. And I know you've been doing this for a long, long, long time. I wanted to talk because they said in the beginning of the show that you are the developer of noimetic psychology. So would you just tell us briefly what that is, and then I want to talk about rethinking depression.
Psychology. I thought it was important that we think about psychology beginning from a different place this time, rather than starting at the place of pathology and loaded words like normal and abnormal. I thought it would be much more useful to wonder what actually matters to human beings, how human beings construe meaning. And when you start from that place, you end up with a different idea about life. You end up with the idea that making meaning may be the most important thing in life for human beings, not happiness and unhappiness, but rather making meaning and making yourself proud. The idea that we, you know, have values and have principles and want to stand behind those values and principles in an everyday way. And if we do that, then we feel good about our efforts. So that seemed to me to be a more interesting starting place than the old-fashioned starting place of what amounts to pathology and what amounts to abnormality.
Right, right. So let's talk about part two of the book, Rethinking Depression, How to Shed Mental Health Labels and Create Personal Meaning. And you call part two your existential plan. So let's look at what you call the existential ideal and its reality.
Well, the existentialism was a philosophy, is a philosophy that demanded a lot of people. It demanded that people take personal responsibility for their life, and that's always been hard for human beings to do. We're pretty tricky creatures. We're pretty defensive. We don't really want to look in the mirror all that well. And so existentialism flourished for a while in the 50s, 60s, maybe 70s, and then faded because it was just a little bit too raw and hard. But its ideas are still the right ideas, that we have to take personal responsibility for this life while we live it. And so I wanted to update some of those ideas and maybe add some new, fresh spins to them. And one thing that I wanted to point out to people is that tens of millions of people have evaluated life as a cheat. They haven't realized they've done that, but somewhere in some corner of consciousness, they've decided that this isn't the way life was supposed to be. Life was supposed to be better than this. And so they may have no, quote, symptoms of depression, but they are unhappy all of the time a little bit because they wanted life to be more than this. And so the existential ideal, so to speak, is to notice this to notice that you've made this evaluation and to, if you can, change your mind and evaluate life as worth living, kind of look the facts of existence in the eye and say, this is okay, this is the life that is, and I'm going to live it as best I can. And by making that switch, by making a new decision to evaluate life more positively, you can reduce your experience of unhappiness dramatically just by having made a new decision.
Yeah. Now, you focus on meaning a great deal through the book. Obviously, we have to have meaning to keep moving forward and to find that level of happiness that we want. But I know that meaning, in quotes, is very hard for some people to find. Talk to us a little bit about that, if you would, please.
Sure. Of course, it's a complicated matter, and that's why, you know, I spend lots of words on it. But let me say a few things. One is the idea that we want to foster this paradigm shift from seeking meaning to making meaning. Rather than thinking the meaning's out there somewhere at the top of a mountain or at some guru's feet, I think we're mature enough as a species now to realize that we don't have to look for meaning anywhere. We have to make decisions about what's meaningful to us and then act on those decisions and then form intentions based on those decisions. And it doesn't have to be one thing. There is no one purpose in life. There are multiple purposes. I talk of them as meaning opportunities. And human beings have discovered that maybe 20 categories of experience prove meaningful, whether it's relationships or creativity or service or stewardship or ambition or excellence. There are all kinds of things that provoke the experience of meaning. So we don't have to do the thing that so many people do, pester ourselves about what one thing is going to prove meaningful, but rather realize that we have this menu of meaning opportunities that we can choose from on a daily basis, and that we can make meaning on a daily basis by choosing from this menu.
Right, right. Now, if somebody's been living with depression for a long time, or we have, you know, maybe ourselves, maybe somebody we live with or care about, you know, there's a tendency for other people to get sucked into this vortex a little. And, you know, I've heard people myself say, they say, oh, my depression. How do people start moving away from that, Eric, when they're creating this meaning for themselves?
Well, you know, I hope that the arguments in the book will prove persuasive to them and they will understand that there is no mental disorder here, but that they're really quite unhappy and that they're going to have to think through what's making them unhappy. It may be their job. It may be their relationship. It may be, as I said a moment ago, their evaluation of life as a cheat. Who knows what it may be, but they need to think that through. And then they need to make, and this is the hard part, they have to make the changes that are consonant with their understanding of what's wrong. They need to right their ship. If they don't right their ship, they can take pills to the end of time. They can take chemicals with effects to the end of time, but that will just, you know, flatten their experience of life out. That won't make changes in the situation that's been causing the unhappiness.
Right.
So they have to look in the mirror is the first step. And then just as importantly, they need to form some strong intentions and then align their thoughts with those intentions. It's amazing how often we'll form an intention like, I want to write a novel. And then the next six thoughts we think don't serve that intention. The next six thoughts might be, well, it's a lot of competition and it's too late. And I'm not sure if I'm talented, et cetera, et cetera. And we make ourselves sad almost instantly. We had an optimistic moment. We decided we were going to write a novel. And then we think of 6 or 8 or 10 things that are negative and we make ourselves sad in the next minute.
And so how do you recommend, because that's like a roller coaster ride. And
it is.
And you do talk about this in the book. You say, you know, just what you said, really, at some point we have to decide, hey, we matter, I matter. And then take responsibility about caring for ourselves. And how do we manage to ride that roller coaster?
Well, obviously, there isn't an answer. There are, I think, many answers in the book. But one thing to remember, and I think this is really important, is that we only have to make as much meaning as we actually need. It's an old-fashioned idea that we need meaning all the time. You might make meaning for 2 hours in some really powerful way, and then you can stay in meaning neutral for the next 2 or 3 hours and run your errands and do your chores and what have you without pestering yourself about whether those 2 or 3 hours were meaningful. And so by introducing this kind of balance in your life where you strongly make meaning for X amount of time and then take vacations for meaning for Y amount of time, you actually reclaim life in a new way. and you, A, feel more instrumental because you're making meaning, but you also take a lot of stress off of your shoulders because you understand that not every moment has to feel meaningful.
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine, excuse me, that if somebody has been in a depressed state for a while,
yes,
that the changes that they start making can feel uncomfortable to some people. So what? How do you work them through that period of discomfort and not just looping back to their comfortable state?
Yeah, well, it's like a recovery program. The same essentials, namely regularity, routine, daily attention to this effort. If you have been severely unhappy for a long time and you want to make changes, then that has to be your number one priority every day, just as for an alcoholic, recovery has to be his number one priority every single day. He can't think about other things first. That comes first. So in my language, I invite clients to engage in a morning meaning practice where just for half a minute or 30, 40 seconds, they make decisions about where they're going to invest meaning on that day. To say that all very simply, we have to pay daily attention to the changes we want to make. And then we want to forgive ourselves for those days when we don't pay attention to those things. There is this dance between doing the work, and if we fail to do the work, forgiving ourselves, and then instantly getting back on the horse. Just again to use the 12-step analogy, mm-hmm. if you have a slip, well, you have to return to your program instantly. You can't let that slip be your excuse to drink alcoholically again. You want to recover from the slip as fast as you can. So we understand that we're not going to do the, so to speak, right things every single day, but we want to be paying good attention to what we're doing. We want to forgive ourselves for our missteps, and then we want to get back to our program.
Yeah. I love this that you say in Chapter 14, Snap Out of Trance. We've hypnotized ourselves into taking the temperature of our moods far too often. Focus on your intentions, not on your mood.
Yeah, and the way I've been saying this recently is meaning can trump mood. You can make decisions about how to make meaning rather than always checking in on your mood. One of the funny things about mood, one of the funny sad things about mood, is we always check in on it when we're when we feel our worst.
Yeah.
Nobody's checking in when they're, you know, cheering at a ball game or, you know, happy at a party or whatever. No one's checking in on their mood then. And so we really underestimate to what extent we're feeling okay much of the time.
Yeah.
We underestimate that because we're not checking in at the right times.
I think that's a really key point you made. And something I came to realization a long time ago with myself was I only journal when I'm frustrated and wanting to make change. and I'm like, how come I never journal about the happy things and the good things that
that's
are going
right. No
on?
Need to. That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, totally lose it. So what do you hope people will really take away from this book? I think it's very timely, and I think it's really useful for somebody who's been in this condition.
Well, I think two things, maybe three things. One is a buyer beware moment where they want to think through what's going on when they approach the mental health system and are given a mental health label. That's A. B, to think through whether they want what the mental health industry provides, namely chemicals and talk of a certain sort. They may well want it, but they want to think that through. And then C is to institute a strong existential program, a strong meaning program, where you make decisions about meaning on a daily basis and make yourself prouder than most people typically do on a given day. Most people don't feel like they're doing enough. They're doing plenty of things, but they feel like they're going through the motions. And mm-hmm. this is a way of not going through the motions, feeling like you're really living your life.
Right. And as I mentioned at the top of the hour, you are one of America's leading creative coaches. Incorporating creativity into our lives help us get through this process?
Well, it's one of our meaning opportunities. It's not our only one, but for many people, it's the place where they feel most comfortable making meaning, or it's the place they want to make meaning the most. So if you've always felt that way about yourself, that creativity was a source of meaning for you or a place to make meaning, and you haven't really seized that opportunity, then you probably want to do that because that is for you psychologically one of your prime meaning-making opportunities, and you don't want to pass it up.
Great. And a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today, Dr. Maisel.
Well, I think that there's actually good news here. I think that meaning is actually infinite. Once we understand that we get to make it and that it's a certain kind of subjective psychological experience and we can have it all the time, then I think life changes for us and we can have a much better experience of life.
Thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate your time. Great book.
Thank you so much.
And you can find out more about Dr. Eric Maisel and his work at Eric with a C, ericmaisel.com. And Maisel is M-A-I-S-E-L. Please do stay with us. When we come back, we'll be joined by Chelsea Handler, writer and stand-up comedian and author, Sarah Colliner, in Life As I Blow It. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Do you have a writer in your life or someone who wants to write but needs help? Give the gift of creative coaching to encourage their passion this holiday season. Vicky St. Clair has been writing professionally for more than 15 years. She can help jumpstart new writers and unblock experienced writers. Each program is tailored to suit a writer's individual needs and can be a single, one-off consultation or multiple coaching sessions. Vicky can also help you navigate the publishing world and explore ways to make over six figures a year with your craft. See more about Vicky at VickySt.Clair.com. For creative coaching details, call 425-269-4772. That's 425-269-4772. Or email Vicky at VickySt.Clair.com.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
If you want to reach a large audience of like-minded people, people with integrity, people who strive to live well and live strong, let Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair shine a spotlight on your message. Tell us about your business, product, service, or event, and we'll help you craft your message and promote your good work. Email Vicky at conversationslive.net or call 425-269-4772. That's 425-269-4772. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
Some people know a good thing when they hear it. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my next guest is Sarah Colliner. She's a writer and roundtable regular on the hit late-night talk show Chelsea Lately and a producer and star of After Lately. She's been performing stand-up comedy in Los Angeles and across the country for several years and has appeared on numerous TV shows. She's currently touring on her own as a headliner as well as part of the Comedians of Chelsea Lately tour. She's also writing and producing a comedy series in development with NBC based on her memoir, which we're going to talk about today, Life As I Blow It. And I see here she used to drink bourbon, but now prefers vodka. Sarah Colliner, welcome.
Hi, how are you, Vicky? Thanks for having me.
Very welcome. You are a busy lady.
I am busy. I'm busy. It's a good thing, though. I've had, 47 bartending jobs at once in the past, too, so I'm not going to complain about these jobs.
Heck no.
No, not at all.
So this book that you've just written, and I know it's doing really well, is called Life As I Blow It, Tales of Love, Life, and Sex, not necessarily in that order. Very funny book, made me laugh out loud many times.
Good, thank you.
Tell us a little bit about it and how much artistic or comedic license you took when you were actually writing it.
You know, it's basically a story about, you know, it's my life and, it's growing up in the South. I grew up in a really small town in Arkansas. My mother and father were separated at a young age. So I grew up in this traditional small town with my mom. And then my dad was living in California and he was a sports editor and he's been married, I don't know, about four times, which isn't so traditional. I kind of grow up seeing these two different worlds laid out in front of you, and you're like, which one am I supposed to be? And you kind of find yourself going, I'm not sure what I want to do, and I think a lot of people can relate to that because, you know, everybody obviously has two parents, and you can, whether or not they're together or divorced or separated or anything, you just see two very different personalities sort of, you know, inside of you.
Right.
And I just found, you know, not to make it sound too serious because it's not, but obviously, you know, in the trying to figure out who you are, there's a lot of those funny stories of, you know, trying to act like a grown up when you're already supposed to be a grown up and you're like, wait a minute, what am I, am I not supposed to be at happy hour right now?
Right.
There's a lot of that in it, you know, and I think a little bit of comedic license with a sense of like conversations, maybe not being word for word if you can't, you know, recall an exact word somebody said or something. But I found that when I was writing it, most of that stuff really kind of came back pretty easily to me, thank God. And so for the most part, it's all very true, you know, good or bad. And, you know, I definitely take the, it's definitely not making fun of other people as much as it is making kind of fun of myself. And, you know, and of course, there's some people in there that, you know, you go on your ridiculous dates. We all have. So I told those stories for sure.
And I read that you actually enjoyed the process of writing. You enjoyed going back and remembering all of these things, but you didn't give much thought to the fact that, hey, somebody else is going to read this at the end until your editor talked to you.
I did. It was so funny because I was just writing it. Like when I've asked the question before, I'm like, I was just writing the truth and writing these stories. I'm like, oh my God, remember this. This is so funny. Or this is really embarrassing. Or this was like a difficult period of my life. And I'm writing about it. And then when it kind of comes back to you and someone's like, okay, so this is about to hit the shelves. And this is the, you know, you have to have like this legal conversation with your lawyer at Random House. And this is, you know, asking you questions. You're like, oh God, I forgot. Like, wait, that person might read it, or this person, you know, like my parents are going to read it. Hold on a second, wait, because you just want to come from an honest place, and I'm not really thinking about, you know, that part of it. But I'm glad, because actually the response has been really positive, even for people that were in there. Like, I wrote this story about this guy when Al was in his 30s and way too into Superman, you know, and I mean, that's, you know, on me that I dated that person, but I definitely made fun of him, and he actually ended up writing me this email that was really generous and sweet about how he thought it was a really funny story, and he was, you know, ridiculous when I knew him, and he took it very well. So, I mean, I don't know if everybody's taking it that way, but I thought that was kind of an interesting response to it.
Well, and I think it helps, as you said, you've made fun of yourself as well and pointed out your foibles. You were seemingly very honest in doing all of that. You were 21 when you moved to California. You moved there because you wanted to act. So tell us about that time of your life.
You know, I always grew up saying I was going to be an actress and a comedian. And, you know, I didn't know as much about the writing. I mean, I knew I liked writing and I knew I wanted to do it, but I didn't know how to incorporate it all together, which obviously once you start doing stand-up, you're like, oh, I'm writing. I'm writing on stage, you know, I'm just writing. But it was interesting. It was, you know, I always said I was going to do it. And so the day that I basically pulled out of my mom's driveway, and I was just like, oh boy, here I go. Like, I guess I'm really doing this, you know, and it was really scary to move, you know, at 21 and didn't really know anybody. I mean, my father is in California, not in LA, but, you know, so I stayed with him for a little bit and saved some money to move up to Hollywood. And the next thing I knew, I was in this one bedroom sharing it with this friend of mine, another girl named Sarah that I knew from back home, because we were both broke and just trying to, you know, pay the rent of a one-bedroom apartment, which was very different than the one-bedroom apartment rent in Fayetteville, Arkansas at the time.
Right, like I can imagine.
Four times as much, yeah. So, you know, it was really, I mean, I wouldn't trade it for anything. It was fun. I definitely learned a lot and have a lot of good stories from it, you know.
Now, this book is, Life as I Blow It, is your memoir, but Chelsea Handler wrote the foreword for the book, and she says that you guys met in an improvisation class when you were both 21 years old and were magnetically drawn to each other because we both looked like we were in our mid-40s.
It's true. Yeah, you know, that's great. We met in this improv class and we were both, you know, trying to do the same thing, and neither of us were very good at the improv class. We were kind of like, I don't think this is what we should be doing. But thank God we took it because, you know, we got to meet and yeah, we were friends instantly, you know, went right to happy hour. So... I've
known
her for years, so it's been really interesting to see, you know, her career and then end up, you know, all this comes kind of full circle. Now I'm working on her show and it's pretty fun.
Well, tell us about that then, because we're jumping way forward now. But so you were actually a roundtable regular. I mean, you'd had a certain amount of good success by then because you were a roundtable regular on her show.
Yeah.
And then one day she asked you to come and join her as a writer full time. Talk a little bit about that and how that came to pass.
Yeah, it was interesting because I was doing a roundtable, you know, and of course she, you know, I've been, like you said, I've done some things. I'd had some, you know, TV shows and like little things here and there that I worked on, but nothing, you know, nothing to let me quit my night job, so to speak, and at the bar. But and then I was doing the roundtable, and then when the day they asked me to start writing, I was kind of I was very surprised because I wasn't expecting that. But when they asked it, it made perfect sense to me because we have some similar sensibilities, you know, Chelsea and I definitely. And you know, what better way to have someone write for you than someone that really understands, you know, your sense of humor? And she also, of course, likes to have people around her that she, you know, believes in. And so it was great. I mean, I just thought there was a moment where I was like, I didn't know I was going to be writing on a talk show. But obviously it's the, you know, best thing really that's happened thus far from my career.
Right, right. So when did you feel, and I'm not sure, maybe you didn't ever really feel this, because I kind of gathered in your book, as you were going back and writing it, you suddenly realized you were a grown-up now. But was there a point in your career when you were doing stand-up comedy and you suddenly felt, hey, yeah, I'm beginning to make it?
You know, there was a couple of points like that, and sometimes I was wrong.
We need those little boosts.
There was a couple of them. Those stories are in there, and you know, but I think, I don't know, it actually may not have even been until I started writing the book. And I mean, I'm almost there to say, like, what, you know, now is when I really feel something, you know, different in the career, just because now that I'm touring with the book and I'm having people coming specifically, it seems, to see me because of the book and the show. And like, they know, you know, like filling up comedy clubs for people that are really there just to see you, then it's starting to go, oh, so people are definitely paying attention, at least responding, you know, favorably. Mm-hmm. To just you rather than just everything else that you're a part of, which is, I mean, and it's obviously from being a part of it and people start to relate to you, you know, of the show and everything, which is great. And so, yeah, I don't know if there was a certain point, but I'm reminded of it right now, which is really helpful because obviously, you know, it's very nerve-wracking to travel and have a book and have all these things and assume people are going to care and want them to. But, you know, it's a little, you know, intimidating. You're like, God, I don't know, is anybody going to show up? And then they do, and you're like, oh, this is amazing. Okay, good.
Right.
You know?
Well,
yeah.
I read that you said one of your favorite stories was when you were having one of the worst sets on stage. I can't imagine. I was at a comedy club down in Tacoma 2 weeks ago, and, you know, we're right in the front row there looking up at this comedian, all the lights blaring. And I thought, God, that must be such a hard job to be up there, and especially when it's not going well. So share that story
definitely
with us, if you would.
Yeah, I was just doing a set for like a showcase for a comedy festival, and I was going on right before Drew Carey, and this was, but I was very new to stand up, but this agent was like, oh, you should showcase, and he had a little, probably too much faith in me, unfortunately, nice of him, but it was misplaced, and I wasn't very, you know, well-crafted. I didn't really know. I just had a little bit of time under my belt. I didn't have a lot of stand-up, you know, material even. I was going up before Drew Carey. All these people were there to see Drew Carey at this big event. And then I come on stage and they're like, who's this girl? And then they don't respond well to my first joke. And the only, you know, so far it was a joke that I'd done a couple of times and everyone had responded well to. So I completely panicked, flew through my set, pretty much got no laughs, and then just like went running off stage before the MC could even come up there, and just left the stage empty, and then went in the bathroom and just had like a basically like a panic attack / crying moment.
Right,
and
right.
It was awful, definitely. And the reason it's one of my favorite stories is because obviously I've learned since then, you know, that when you are, you know, doing something like stand up and people aren't responding, you just have to work harder to win them over. Like, I've had, you know, I still have moments where maybe someone's like, they don't appreciate that material as much. I mean, I obviously have learned to know what I think will work and what won't, you know, in certain crowds too. So it's less and less, and it's definitely never been just, you know, now, because I've learned so much. It's not like you go up there and have those experiences anymore. People respond well because you know what you're doing and you're confident, and I think seeing me all up there all flustered and nervous and crazy just made everyone else go like, what is this? Why are we bothering to watch this girl? You know? And even though it was devastating, it taught me a lot. And it also gave me, you know, after I cried for probably 3 days, it gave me motivation to work harder.
Yeah.
So I'm glad it happened now. I wasn't so glad then.
Right. But I think oftentimes those are, as you said, the moments when we learn the most about ourselves and how to cope with different situations.
Definitely.
And we're going to take a very quick break. And then when we come back, I'm going to ask you what it's like working in that kind of environment, because it is still heavily male dominated. It's getting better. But people like you are really showing the way there. But it's still heavily male dominated. So please do stay with us. We're talking with Sarah Colonna. Her new memoir, very funny book, is called Life As I Blow It, Tales of Love, Life, and Sex, Not Necessarily in That Order. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
She's a funny kind of girl. Set sail in a ship in a bottle. She's a funny kind of girl.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967 because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job, and building your business. Overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Following the herd is fine until they lead you off a cliff. Think for yourself. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And we're talking in this segment with Sarah Colonna. She is an author, the author of Life As I Blow It, which is her new memoir. She's also a writer and roundtable regular on the hit late night talk show Chelsea Lately, and a producer and star of After Lately. So I wanted to ask you, Sarah, what it's like for a woman in that business. Because, you know, I think back years gone by and the women who used to be stand-up comedians, you know, they often used to wear pants and some, I remember, wearing ties. I mean, you're very feminine. And what's the whole
Thank
deal?
You.
What's the whole deal with what it's like to work in that environment now?
You know, I think luckily over the years it's definitely changed, like you're saying, and it's a little less about the gender and just more about what people think is funny. But you definitely encounter, just like I think forever people will, just, you know, people of certain mindset who just, they cross their arms and like, women aren't funny, or they're just going to talk about their period or whatever.
Right,
I'm like, no, I would never discuss that. But I think that, you know, I think luckily now it seems like more people are just wanting to laugh and be something that people can relate to. And I really try, even though obviously I am a woman, so I'm probably going to appeal a lot more to, you know, a female audience or gay male audience. I do think that I find that a lot of straight men are relating, you know, to my comedy, and I want them to. And I think it's just because, and, you know, and Chelsea is the same way, and people like Whitney Cummings, and you know, it's, I think people can go, oh, she's just talking about being a person. It's not about, you know, it's like
something
that I can relate to. Everybody can relate to, you know, relationship stuff and job stuff and just things we experience every day. So it's a little less of that, but I definitely find that you encounter it from time to time, people being a little more judgmental, you know?
Yeah. Lucille Ball and Carol Burnett, I read, were two people who influenced you along the way. How so?
Yeah. I for so long, like, my mom used to make me watch, you know, reruns of I Love Lucy. And I just grew, and then I started watching Carol Burnett's show on, you know, when it was obviously, I don't know if it was still, I guess it wasn't necessarily on when I was, but it was, you know, in reruns or whatever it was. But I don't think I've ever laughed so hard. And obviously it's a different time. And I know that people, you know, some people would say, well, Lucy Ball was, you know, but it was the 50s. So for her time, she was, you know, very forward thinking and very ballsy,
oh, yeah,
as you would say. And Carol Burnett as well. I mean, and also I would just love to watch that show because the fact they couldn't even keep straight faces was one of my favorite things. I was like, what a great, what a great atmosphere to be in. Like, how could, you know, could you imagine just being able to just crack up on television and completely get away with it and nobody gets mad at you and you're like, we know we're having the best time here. And I just love both of them and just find them both to be so funny. And I was sort of always inspired to have, you know, a little bit of their, I don't know, of their legend in me or something, like in my comedy, like something, you know, that they did, like, you know, like Lucy with her own TV show and making these ridiculous stories, you know, so funny, and situations that she would get herself into. I mean, who doesn't want to, you know, do something like that?
Right, right. I was watching a documentary that just reminded me when you said that, because I know, you know, it's not easy. It's still a job. You still have to do the work. How much time and effort goes into, let's say you're writing, you know, for the Chelsea Handler show. Let's say you're doing some writing there. What's a typical day like for you?
We come in, we're full time, you know, like kind of a 9 to 6, I guess, regular time. Because we tape it through 3:30 in the afternoon so that it can be ready for the East Coast, you know, that night. Cause it's obviously live to tape. But we come in at 9. We start kind of going over, like, what the opening monologue will be about and what, you know, we have a research department that watches shows for us and so pulls clips that we think that we can, you know, make fun of and write something for her, you know, a monologue about. And or we'll if one of us saw something or we come up with a, you know, a rant for her or whatever. And then we go in the writer's room and start pitching out topics of the day that we found, you know, these ridiculous stories. Obviously it's nothing, you know, too serious. It's the fight at Chuck E. Cheese or Lindsay Lohan dyes her hair or whatever.
Right.
And just kind of try to get the topics that we know that we can have the most fun with. And it becomes hard sometimes because we you know, there are only so many, you know, like you can only talk about Lindsay Lohan so many times before you're like, all right, this is, you know, we're running out of jokes on her or it's not funny anymore or something. So we definitely try to search for, you know, these like off-beat news topics that aren't necessarily celebrity, but that are just more, you know, kind of ridiculous, you know, stories like,
right,
like a Chuck E. Cheese or, you know, there's always a fight at a McDonald's drive-thru. I mean, come on, someone's always mad about something. So, you know, we start pitching those and then we write up the topics after that and give her the jokes and she picks, you know, and sometimes she does the jokes that you write. Sometimes she goes completely off on her own. Sometimes it's 50-50. You just never know. So, but you just have to give her enough material to have in case she isn't, you know, has whatever, doesn't come up with something on her own for that you know, particular thing. But then it's also so off the cuff because of the round table. None of us know what the other person's going to say, so it can always take this crazy direction, too.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that, because that's actually the favorite part of the show for me, is the round table. And it seems, and I happened, this was real coincidence, because I came home from the theater on Saturday night. It was, I don't know, 2 or 3 in the morning, and I was flicking through TV, and I happened to see you on the round table.
And, oh, good.
and I was wondering, you know, how much of that is total improv? Do you have an outline of what you're going to talk about in the roundtable section, or is it more, you know, go with the flow kind of thing?
It's a, you have to be, what we, I think for the most part, what everybody tries to do is you know, well, I'll know the topics a little bit more advanced, like all the writers do, because we, you know, we're pitching them in the morning, but we're not working on our own stuff, obviously, until, you know, later. And then the other comics, they get the topics like a couple hours before the show. So you have time to kind of think of, you know, I think the good rule is to come up with like 1 or 2 good jokes on the subject. However, like I said, you don't know what anyone else is going to do. And, mm-hmm. and we don't like to talk about it because we think that'll lose the spontaneity.
Yeah.
So someone could either say something you were going to say, you know, or something close to it, or it can take you in a different direction. So it's good to have a couple jokes ready about something, but also be totally, don't be married to it, because you never know. And it becomes really obvious if you're just like trying to get your one joke in.
Right,
it kind of
right.
can kill the flow. We want it, you know, everybody wants it to be very conversational and fun and off the cuff. And so, and you just never know. So it's good to be prepared, but don't be married to what you've prepared. that makes sense.
Absolutely. Now, I heard David Steinberg on the CBS Morning Show this morning. He's a stand-up legend, and he is also the director of Inside Comedy, which is a new show coming out. But he said that, in his opinion, comedians are born with it in them. Would you agree with that?
I think there's a certain level of that that's true, and probably in any profession. Like, I think, you know, you can always learn how to fine-tune any skill, I think, but you definitely have to have an inkling of it in you. And I think that's, you know, a good amount of it. And, you know, just like, just like a brain surgeon, I mean, probably is born with some sort of steady hand, skilled, you know, very, medical brain that obviously I would never be able to just pick up. So, and nobody would want me to. So I think in any career that you have sort of a skill in you, and that you can learn to fine tune it for sure. But I think there's a level of it you have to be born with.
Mm. Well, I was watching this film that I was talking about earlier, and I just the name escapes me right now. But it was following some comedians around America, and one of them said, "You know, I think we've all got serious mental defects. I think we're all mentally ill." But I have to say that particular group were like a bunch of 11-year-old boys, so maybe they're not the norm there.
Right. Yeah.
But go ahead.
I find people say that. I find people say, like, oh, comedians have to be disturbed in some kind of way. I don't necessarily agree with that. I mean, I've met plenty that are and plenty that aren't, and I think you probably have to have a little bit of crazy in you to want to get on stage and subject yourself to the possibility of people just going, shut up. So maybe there is a little bit of truth in it somewhere. But I think, you know, I think everyone's got a little crazy in them somewhere.
Absolutely. We wouldn't, we need that crazy to give birth, you know, to other stuff, right?
Absolutely. For the day.
Yeah. Looking back on your career, because it has been so diverse and you've achieved such great success now, what do you know now that you wish you'd known when you were 21 and you landed in LA?
That's a good question. So congratulations on that. Like, what is a good? That is a good question. And I'm stumped. I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, I guess I wish I would have known a little bit more about the stand up in general and about, you know, the competitiveness and some of the people, you know, because I did grow up in a small town, and I went to school at the University of Arkansas. And for the most part, even though there was some competitiveness, even in theater there and things like that, people were pretty supportive. But it's a little jarring at first when you're trying to do something, and I definitely met some people along the way that aren't as supportive, and people who just sort of think, oh, this, you know, if you have a job, that means I didn't get the job, instead of thinking, no, which is the way I think and the way obviously Chelsea thinks, which is why she's able to be, you know, confident enough to bring people up around her, that it's like, no, if people are working, that just means good. There's work out there. That just means keep it going, you know?
Yeah.
So I wish I would have known that I would, you know, I mean, I learned it quickly and I'm glad, but, you know, and I've been very lucky to meet mostly supportive people, especially my friends in comedy and stuff like that. But I've definitely encountered the few sort of not so supportive, you know, get out of my way or I'm going to run you over kind of people. And that can be a little bit jarring.
Well, hopefully you're crossing paths now as you're coming out, they're going the other way.
Yeah, exactly.
Karma.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And I think confidence would be a huge factor in all of this. We're right at the end of our segment, Sarah. Great talking with you. And this is a
thank you very much.
Really funny book. What's the final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Just that, you know, I think the book and what I hope for it is that it seems to be the response I'm getting, that people really relate to it. And no matter what, you know, industry you're in, it's really not about a specific, like, me trying to be a comedian or me trying to, you know, be in a relationship or me trying to, it's just about what it's like trying to sort of balance your life with a career and fun and figure out how to make all that work and have people, you know, accept you for who you are. So I think it's really relatable, and I think it's funny, you know, and I feel like, you know, hopefully people will give it a chance.
Yeah, I think that's that was the key takeaway I took away from it. The ups and downs is, and, you know, the confusion in the beginning when you didn't know which path to take, just be yourself. I think that's true for everything in life. And let's have your website where people can find out more about you.
Oh, yeah, it's sarahcolonna.com, 2N, C-O-L-O-N-N-A. And it has all my tour dates and stuff on it, too. So.
Super. Super. Thank you
Great.
So much, Sarah Colonna, for joining us today. Appreciate
Thank you.
It.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And okay. Sarah's book, again, is called Life as I Blow It, Tales of Love, Life, and Sex, Not Necessarily in That Order. And I want to thank you for being with us today. We'll be back next week with an all-new live show. You can reach me at info@conversationslive.net if you have questions or comments on today's show, or 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. Thanks for being with us. See you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.